This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, in for Farai Chidea, who's on vacation. On today's roundtable, health care. It's a front burner issue this week in Washington. We'll look at who's saying what. North Korea and the U.S., just how close are they to a deal on the nuclear question? And spare the rod, spoil the child. But not if a California legislator gets her way. She says there ought to be a law against spanking. Joining us to discuss these and other issues on this edition of Roundtable are Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at NYU. Nice to have everybody with us.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Let's start with topic number one. On the very weekend that Hillary Clinton made her presidential bid official, her presidential campaign bid official, I should say, she raised the issue of health care and vowed to bring legislation that would make, as she put it, quality health care available to every child in America. Now, she's certainly no stranger to the issue of comprehensive health care, but we all know what happened when she pushed this agenda as the former first lady. So, Callie, to you, how much traction does health care have this time, and who in Washington will have the most leverage to deal with it?
I'll have to think about the second part, but the first part is there's a lot of traction right now. Maybe it's because it's the moving up of the baby boomers who find themselves in that sandwich position dealing with health care for their children as well as for their aging parents. And maybe it's because there's just a real good population of elders who are alert, aware, and political and who made their voices heard so that there was some kind of addressing to their one of their major problems, which was ended up being prescription D as we know it. I live in Massachusetts, where the former governor Mitt Romney put this on the table, universal health care in this state. And it's, you know, as you can imagine, it's not the most popular bill for businesses, but he got it through. And I think that the new governor, Patrick, is going to make it happen in some way. Yes, it's flawed in many ways. We could talk about that. But the bottom line is the time is now. People need some relief to take care of these issues. And it's starting on the states. And I think that those people, those folks who have been in positions like the Governor Romney's to really get ahead of the game and deal with it may, in fact, get a little bit more attention on the national scene.
Let me bring Robert George in. You're an editorial writer. Do you see it as a front burner issue?
Most definitely. I have to agree, what Callie just said. And in fact, the second part of the question that you put in there, who's best positioned in Washington to address this issue, actually, I think it was slightly wrong because, as Callie said, the actual best changes on health care front are, or I shouldn't necessarily say the best changes, but some of the most sweeping changes are actually coming from the state level. Whether it's Mitt Romney in Massachusetts, Arnold Schwarzenegger out in California, just introduced a large plan last year as well, and so you're getting a lot of pressure that's actually coming from the states. And I will, even though I may disagree with what Hillary Clinton is actually going to be putting on the table, the fact is she was there about a dozen years ago, and in a sense it was seen at the time as pushing out this huge, complicated, really messy bureaucratic operation. What we've had now in the last 12 years are different people coming up with different solutions on healthcare issues, and so I think there's a much broader number of people who can actually have a full discussion on it.
Well, to follow up on your point, Robert, with Marcelo, the president is expected to talk about healthcare on Tuesday during the State of the Union speech. Now, he has a proposal as well, and his, from what we are told, blends healthcare reform with a little tax reform, having those with so-called gold standard health insurance pay a tax on it to help finance coverage for those who don't have it. So to go back to Robert's point, is this better coming from the states, or does the administration have something that people will really pay attention to?
Well, what is interesting is that really we're going to have multiple initiatives because what we're facing here is really the gathering of a perfect storm. We have millions and millions of baby boomers who will now enter the demographic winter of their lives, and we have skyrocketing healthcare costs that simply continue to go up and up and up. It seems to me that the notion of creating a formula, as probably will be announced on Tuesday, where various stakeholders will receive various incentives for the generation of a momentum where the millions of Americans, one in six now, who has no health care coverage, can get coverage. So let's wait and see. Let's hear the details. What I see here is something very much mimicking, very much similar to what's going on in the immigration debate, where the failure at the federal government is creating a vacuum, and the states, the localities are moving very, very fast to fill in that vacuum with alternative initiatives.
The democratic winter of their lives, a very nice phrase. I like that.
I was actually almost changing around to the winter of their demographic discontent. But
I like that one as well. You're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai today. In case you are just tuning in, with me on today's roundtable are Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator on the city's television show Beat the Press, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, the professor of globalization and education at NYU. All right, let's go on to another topic. Let's talk for a moment, if we can, about North Korea. The top U.S. nuclear envoy was optimistic on Friday after 3 days of talks in Berlin with his North Korean counterpart, but it's hard to gauge the actual progress here because no details were given. Now, talks are good, but how significant, I'm going to come to you first, Robert, how significant is this development in our back-and-forth negotiations with Pyongyang?
Well, I mean, as you said, you have to take a lot of these things with a grain of salt. Well, partly because, as you said, we don't know the full details, but particularly because North Korea has not exactly been the most straightforward when it comes to living up to these agreements. They took advantage of a very serious loophole that was left in the 1994 agreement that was negotiated between Jimmy Carter and the Clinton administration and Pyongyang, and as a result, that's what's brought us to this situation right now. It's great that we've been engaged with them. It's great if there is actually a deal on the table. But given how Kim Jong-il is frankly not to be trusted, I'd like to see what kind of safeguards that the administration may have negotiated to see that they actually have a real deal that can be, as they said back in the days of the Cold War, that not just trust but verified.
You know, what do you think about that, Callie? Do you think that there is an impact that is discernible at this point with regard to the wider arms talks when they reconvene?
Yes, I would have to even underscore what Robert just said. It is great that we as a country have engaged with them, and I think that is the significance. I mean, there hadn't been any talks, and in fact, it was getting very ugly. Whether we trust the man or not, we know who he is. The fact that they are in conversation and that all at the table, even without details, characterize the exchange as positive, I have to take that as good. Not only in this scenario, I'm going to expand and say that means that maybe when we look toward Iraq and Iran and Syria, we can think about sitting down at the table with other folks we don't like either and we don't trust, but toward moving to some ends that are positive for all involved. So if this means anything to me, it means that there is a way to sit down with folks you may not trust or like, and that conversation does work.
Marcelo, I want to bring you in on it, but I want to throw something else on the table before you respond, and that's this. Perhaps of more immediate concern for now is the anti-satellite weapons test just conducted by China, in which one of their own weather satellites was shot down. Now, the question for the Bush administration and for China's neighbors is, what exactly does this mean? And particularly coming as it does at the time that we're having these discussions, good or bad, with North Korea.
I think that the the two issues, the North Korea issue and the satellite issue, really underscore the growing importance of China as a world power. I've just returned from Beijing, and it's really breathtaking to see the economic growth and really the new ambition of China in terms of its voice in the world stage. I think that we're going to see them as playing increasingly a central role in our negotiations with the North Koreans, and in terms of the issue of space and the destruction of the satellite, the domain of economic activities worldwide. The next generation, the next 20 years, are going to shift the focus and the center of gravity in terms of our thinking about foreign policy issues in the United States, much more, I think, increasingly towards China and towards that region of the world.
I want to bring you wanted to drop in there before I go on, Robert?
I was just going to say I agree wholeheartedly with that. I visited Beijing and Shanghai on a kind of a journalistic enterprise over there in July and August, and it's clear in the context of obviously how much economic growth they're having, the construction that's going everywhere. Obviously, they're preparing for the Beijing Olympics as well, and this is a way for them to kind of show that hey, you know, we are a world power. We expect to be seen as a world power, and we're going to flaunt a little bit of our military prowess as well, just to remind people of that fact.
There's really no simple or a smooth way to segue into the next topic, but we're going to do it anyway. We're going to go domestic, and we're going to talk about spanking. California moms may have to put their switches and belts down because a California assemblywoman from the Bay Area says that she is proposing legislation that would make spanking children under the age of 3 illegal. Now, if it passes, California would be the first to adopt such a measure. Currently, though, it is illegal for anyone except the parent to spank a child in California. So let's just get our cards on the table. I'm a parent. I have spanked my children. Now, I don't know if any of you have children and whether or not you spank them. So let's find out. Callie, you don't have any kids, right?
I have no kids. I have a niece and nephew, but I this is a cultural thing. You know, absolutely, I believe in spanking. Though I do have to say that with regard to this particular piece of legislation, the issue is kids 3 and younger.
Right.
And, you know, so a lot of people may fall into a murky area there and say, well, I don't know about that. Maybe there are different ways of handling it. But, you know, it'll be a lot of black folks in jail or fined, I think, if this thing goes through.
Well, they don't call it the terrible twos for nothing. What about you, yes, Marcelo?
Well, you know, it is a cultural issue, as Callie said. But all cultures that we know through history and through ethnography, have a very clear division between disciplining children and child abuse. And in a way, really, it is that boundary that is at stake. When parents feel increasingly monitored, surveyed by the powers that be, I think that that in general tends to erode family authority, family cohesion. There is a very clear boundary separating the need to discipline children, including a little spanking, and the need to protect children from child abuse.
What about in your house, though, Marcelo? Spanking or no spanking?
You know, we really did. We have two kids, and I wish I'd done more spanking. I can assure you, I grew up in Latin America. There was a lot of spanking when I was growing up.
Robert George, bring us your thoughts on this and what your personal experience is.
No kids here. And if I did, I don't know. would probably take some kind of a middle of the road approach. But first of all, I mean, just in terms of the issue at hand here, so to speak, I think it's actually ridiculous that you've got a state legislator, getting into what is just basically the personal rights of parents to discipline their child. I mean, you know, what's considered a spanking? You know, is it a paddle? Is it a belt? Or if you've got a two or three year old, and you need to give them like a swat on the behind to make sure that they don't like run out in the middle of traffic, and then if somebody sees that, are they then going to report them to the local cops? I mean, I think it's just absolutely ridiculous, and once again showing that some legislators somehow feel that they need to prove their existence by passing stupid laws.
Well, you know, that has been the argument against this. We have about a minute left. I want to address something that you all have mentioned. You said that this is a cultural phenomenon, and I want to talk about the stereotype really briefly. I'm going to come to you, Callie, because there is a stereotype that white people don't spank their kids and black people do spank their kids. Is that an accurate stereotype, do you think?
Yeah. Inaccurate or accurate?
I'm asking, is it accurate?
Yeah, I think it's, I think it's pretty accurate.
Do you?
And by the way, a lot of white kids got spanked by black folks who were, you know, housekeeping for white people. So, you know, there are some out there that who understand the culture as well.
Let me say that among immigrants coming to the United States, the most important concern parents have is the perception that they really can't discipline their children because they're going to be getting into trouble. This is true for Caribbean parents. This is true for Latino parents. This is true for Asian parents.
All right, we're going to have to stop it here. Otherwise, all three of you are going to get spanked. Robert George is editorial. Wait a minute. That has a different meaning, doesn't it? Okay. I'm sorry. Just take that back. Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post. Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at NYU. And Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator, joined us from member station WGBH in Boston. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.